So I think that this is a big episode of Trekabout.
Oh my God.
We have a transition with Deep Space Nine to talk about. But before we do that, we have some exciting news.
What is it?
We have a Patreon now.
Oh my God.
So if you would like to give us some money for doing this show, no obligation. You certainly don't have to. But if you feel like, you know, we've been doing the show for a while now. It's been over 3 years, believe it or not.
Oh, my God.
And we're right in the middle of doing a 7-episode season of a new podcast called Trekabout Presents about the Star Wars franchise. So, you know, we feel like we give you some good stuff. And if you would like to throw us a couple bucks, that would be fine.
Help us pay our hosting.
That's kind of the big thing. You know, we actually do spend some money on hosting. We spend some money on hosting for the podcast, hosting for the site. There are some costs involved. And, you know, it's fine. It's not a big deal. But again, if you like the show and you want to support us monetarily, again, no pressure. You know, the show is not going to go under a paywall or anything like that. But there are some cool perks there. One of which is some special episodes that Richard and I are planning to do.
They're going to be so special.
For a certain tier on the Patreon. And it'll be things like Richard and I talking about previous episodes of Star Trek that we liked or disliked. Maybe we disagreed on, you know, revisiting some episodes, things like that. And so we have some ideas of things we want to do. And, you know, if you give us some money, you'll get to hear them. If not, you won't. But again, this show is never going to be paid, so don't feel bad about that. We may do some things in the back episodes, but we haven't decided about that yet. So that's it.
Yeah.
If you want to...
Give us your money.
Give us your money. If you want to check it out, we have links on the website at trekaboutshow.com. You can check out the link there. You can check out the link on the post for this. Check out the link in the show notes of your podcatcher. Or you can check out Twitter or Facebook. We also have the links up there. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. I'm excited. Are you excited?
I'm very excited.
Okay. Let's move on to talk about the third season of Deep Space Nine premiere, The Search Parts 1 and 2, which I think we'll probably just talk about in one go. Yeah, this is a big set of episodes.
Holy shit. That's
how you feeling, Richard?
Oh my God! So I actually, you know, they are structured as two separate episodes, and I think, you know, there is some merit into talking about them as two separate episodes. But yes, they are. This is a big story. This is the status quo of the series, or the premise of the series. You know, making itself a bit more clear, or setting different lines that had been set up in the finale of the last one. We get the answers to two major questions. Who are Odo's people? Who is the Dominion? It turns out to be the same answer, and suddenly everything is a lot scarier.
Were you expecting that?
Not really, although in retrospect, everything was very well clued.
It's actually really interesting you say that, because the idea for Odo's people, the founders, the changelings, whatever. And interestingly enough, I don't actually think that the episode makes it explicit that the changelings are the founders, but it's pretty clear that they hadn't decided on that. This was another case of between seasons 2 and 3 deciding that Odo's people were going to be the shadow group behind the Dominion. And I think, you know, it's obviously a really good choice. It makes perfect sense. And I think it's kind of the best example of this sort of on the fly storytelling that you can get. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about how planned out arcs have their advantages, but I think a lot of times they are kind of constraining in a way as well. And I think that one of the nice things about this is that it feels very organic, it makes sense, but it also wasn't planned out. And so it feels exciting in a way that I think, you know, is very different from that sort of planned out arc could be.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I didn't realize that it hadn't been planned out. That almost sounded like, you know, something that had been from, because it makes complete sense, you know, but.
Right. And it certainly wasn't. I think it's funny because Rene Auberjonois was actually very reticent about Odo finding his people. He thought that would sort of suck a lot of the drama out of it. And, you know, I think that, I don't know, how do you feel about that? Because, you know, at the end of The Search Part 1, you know, the big reveal is that they go to this planet at the Omicron Nebula, and here are Odo's people. And nothing is revealed about them. That's sort of the cliffhanger of the episode, and To Be Continued comes up. How did you feel about that?
I mean, once, you know, I didn't realize that they would he would find them so much so quickly, kind of in the series. But you know, if it had been that they had been, you know, another species that, you know, could be allied with, yes, that would have taken a lot of the mystery out of it. But as is revealed in the second episode, they are Odo's enemies as at the same time as they are his people. And so suddenly the conflict within Odo is actually deepened by finding him. And that actually makes him, I would say he can be even more of an interesting character now.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think that that's one of the things that sort of assuaged, you know, René Auberjonois, is that he realized that he was going to find, you know, Odo was going to find his people, but immediately be sort of separated from them again.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting because he realizes during the the course of this episode that he doesn't quite like his people in some ways. I mean, he's, you know, while he's talking, what do they call it, this joining,
the Great Link.
The Great Link, you know, he's uncomfortable with that. And even as he, you know, appreciates some of it, I mean, he as he says himself, Odo's a very solitary person. He likes to keep to himself. He doesn't, you know, the idea of this, you know, his people are just a gigantic blob with only, you know, weird, without much individuality is horrifying to him. I mean, he has been searching for home, but he has found a home among the solids, you know. This episode, you know, these episodes make it clear, especially between Sisko and Kira, that, you know, they do very much value him, you know, Kira especially. And, you know, during this episode, he begins to realize that, you know, that, and again, it gives a tragic dimension to this. You know, now he has to figure out how to, can he resolve things with his people? Can he resolve this conflict? You know, the two of them are diametrically opposed to each other in some ways.
Well, yeah, and I think that you know, that's all true. And you know, we're kind of talking about this backwards, but I think that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, that you know, you mentioned like, oh, well, Odo doesn't like being, you know, Odo likes being alone. He's solitary, et cetera, et cetera. And it's kind of like my question about that is, you know, what does that actually mean? Right. Because we don't actually get a lot of answers about what the changelings are, the Great Link. You know, the implication is that they sort of, you live in this ocean of changelings. But, you know, and yes, there are individual changelings. But what does that mean? Like, you know, because Odo, there's this interesting exchange between Odo and the changeling who is,
yeah,
his, you know, whatever in this episode, his sort of spirit guide or something. And it, interestingly enough, she's just called female changeling. So we'll just we'll go with that. But, you know, he says, oh, well, I was an infant. And she kind of pauses and she says, yeah, that's right. Right. And, but is it right? You know, like, do they have infants? Like, is there individuality in that sense? I mean, are there pieces of one entity that are sort of breaking off and going away? Like, what does consciousness actually mean for the changelings?
I know. Yeah. Like, this has been kind of a question that's been in the back of my mind. But if could Odo divide into two halves and each be an Odo? You know?
Right. Exactly.
Is there, you know, would one develop into a completely different person from that? I mean, but, you know, I would, you know, that whole sending out infants actually disturbs me a lot because, you know, Odo was essentially sent as a probe, basically.
Yeah, and I think it really marks the changelings as very different from solids, to use their term, because I don't think that they really think of them as infants. I think that she agrees with Odo in that scene just to kind of, you know, assuage him a little bit.
Yeah, but to go with his terminology, you know. It doesn't,
right.
You know, this is not the time to deal with that, but yeah, we'll go with it.
But the sense that I always get is like, you know, it doesn't necessarily track with how the changelings actually operate.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting to contrast the changelings with the Borg because, you know, in a way, one of the, you know, while they didn't turn out to be the big bad of, you know, TNG, they were certainly one of the most iconic villains. And both of them are collective societies and societies with no sense of individuality. I mean, in some ways,
which I don't actually know, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily true, at least for the changelings, but that's a separate
issue.
But,
you know, yeah, it's, I would say that, you know, the concept of individuality is irrelevant because, you know, you can separate into different patterns of thoughts, but it's this, you know, it is the group is where the intelligence goes, you know, same way as the Borg for a lot of ways, you know, the individual units are drones that can be instilled with its intelligence.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I mean, obviously, yeah. I think we'll get answers for what exactly changelings are. Are they individuals? Are they not? Yeah. I think that you could obviously go both ways. And I don't know that we have enough information right now.
But, you know, I get the sense that Odo is almost like, you know, the metaphor that I'm using in my own head is like a single Borg drone, and just how when, you know, Hugh is, you know, separated from his collective, he begins to develop individuality. Odo does. Oh, that's what's happened to Odo. I was finding myself thinking about the shapeshifter in Aquiel, which could be, I don't know if that's ever, you know, said that that's one of the changelings that was sent out or not.
No. But I don't think that that's, I don't think that's supposed to be the same species.
Okay. But I mean, it very well could have been, you know, in its own way. And that's something that was not, you know, given among scientists and, you know, taught like that.
Sure,
and
sure.
So became, I mean, that creature was a bit more feral than certainly Odo is.
Yeah.
And Odo has had his episode of ferality in the one where he met a scientist's father.
That's true. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's also really an interesting concept because, you know, at towards the end of the Search Part Two, when the female changeling is saying, we sent you out and we sent a bunch of you out and, you know, like all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And we wanted you to sort of like experience the galaxy and bring back information to us or whatever she was saying. You know, it's kind of a profoundly weird thing to do, but it also shows exactly kind of the long term planning that they have because, you know, she, yeah. You get the sense in this episode that changelings are extraordinarily long lived if they are not immortal. And so, you know, she said that we didn't think that Odo was going to come back for 300 years or something. And that's like implying that Odo was very long lived. That changelings are very long lived.
It said like, you know, a decade, for example, you know, that's the, I think they ask at one point how long this has been going on and they don't really answer that question, but imply that it's, you know, time beyond reckoning almost.
Right. Exactly. I mean, these are sort of primordial beings in a way. And it's interesting because they treat, you know, especially in the Search Part Two, which we'll talk about the structure of that, but they're toying with the Federation. You know, they obviously have known about the Federation for a long time, it seems.
Yeah.
And they weren't exactly anticipating being in contact with them so quickly and getting Odo back so quickly, but this is a group of people or whoever that have some pretty long term plans, and we don't know exactly what they are, but they don't seem great.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, again, they remind me of the similarities to the Borg have to be intentional. That's another contact that was made before kind of everyone expected it to be and, you know, perhaps before the Borg were ready.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about how, you know, her speech about, you know, you have to be this plant, you know, to understand it, you know, and what, you know, what you become is, you know, understanding of the world.
Right, right.
And she finds it, you know, surprising that, you know, Odo doesn't do this as a matter of course. I mean, that's assimilation in its own way. You know, they are trying to be everything just as the Borg is trying to be everything.
Yeah, but they're going about it in a different way,
yes.
Of course. I mean, they're very much, you know, passive in
a
sense.
And I think their motivations are different because there is this, you know, one of the themes I'm starting to see in Deep Space Nine is that, you know, at what point does, you know, righteous fighting for your, you know, freedom, you know, and against oppression become oppression itself. You know, in the Mirror Universe, we see Bajor becoming an oppressor. You know, we've seen the Federation, you know, the old Federation Mirror Universe had become an oppressor and is, you know, the force used against it is, you know, too much. So, you know, we see this, you know, their story about, you know, how we were originally, you know, trying to, you know, they originally had the Federation mission of, you know, going out and seeking new worlds. And, you know, their treatment was because they are so different from everybody else. You know, where the Federation is welcomed in a lot of places because they can be understood, the changelings weren't. And now they, in a way, are getting revenge and they, you know, want to control the galaxy. And that's their way of, you know, getting back and, you know, getting their, you know, that's justice for them in a way.
Of course, they could also be lying.
Well, they could also be lying. But given the context, I don't know if that's not the read I got from it. And certainly, you know, the Borg's motivation was just solely, It was a very, it was a much simpler motivation. They just want to consume everything.
Yeah, you know, we don't know a lot about how the Borg came about.
Yeah.
And we can certainly infer how they came about, but we don't know. And I think that the interesting thing about the founders here is that we also don't know. We get kind of more of a backstory, but in a sense, it seems like kind of an abused child backstory.
Yeah.
And it's lashing out to a large degree and in kind of terrifying ways. I mean, you know, you get the sense that we don't, you know, that we only get a sense of what the Gamma Quadrant is like. I mean, you said in the second season and even the first season, the Gamma Quadrant is populated by assholes. And I think that really does, you know, make sense now. I think it's kind of a retcon. I don't think they were in anticipating that, but it does work because of course the Gamma Quadrant is something that obviously is not a very happy place. And you know, I think that if you are under the gun of the Dominion, it's not a good thing. You know, there's always this sense that, you know, you've got, they're saying, you know, oh, well, they've got these Jem'Hadar, they'll send the Jem'Hadar in, you know, if you don't join the Dominion, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing. You know, there's the carrot and stick, and you don't want the stick. I mean, you don't really want the carrot either, but...
You know, I guess I think it's interesting because Odo's backstory was that he was found by these scientists and... They found it fascinating, and he felt like, you know, he's a lab experiment, all of that, and, you know. But, I mean, that's even so much more benevolent than, you know, what apparently the Gamma Quadrant's reaction to the changelings was, you know. The Federation, you know, the Bajorans, they've accepted Odo as somebody who's very capable, you know. Even if he doesn't completely fit with Federation policies, you know, they at least, you know, they respect him. They respect his individuality. That's a policy that... You know, that's a policy that the Federation, you know, at this point we know would follow without question in regards to Odo. So,
yeah, but again, I mean, you're only getting the story from a founder, and I mean,
and that's true. And I mean, you know, it could also be, you know, you say it's an abused child, you know, perspective, but I think there is a, when you have that kind of a mindset, you know, you do take everything as a indication of abuse. You know, when you've had a little bit, you take, you know, so much more. You know, that's what you expect. That's what you go into. You know, I think after, you know, a few bad times with other species, you know, were the changelings probably so nice in the next one? You know, they probably got a, you know, we don't know what, maybe we will learn more about their backstory, but.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the open question at this point. I mean, I you know, you seem to be more on the side that you think the changelings are being a little more forthright than
I do.
Well,
I guess it's a case of, I believe that they believe that they were abused by all the other species in the Gamma Quadrant.
I don't know. Do they? I don't know. I you know, there's part of me that's kind of like, I know stuff that happens later, and there's part of me that's just being devil's advocate here, but.
And part of me that also recognizes that this was thousands and thousands of years ago too.
Right. Yeah. It certainly could be. And I think that,
you know, however bad it was thousands of years ago, that's not the case now. You know what I mean? Like it's like the whole, you know, I'm 32. I can't, you know, be upset about something that happened when I was in high school, you know, kind of thing. Like at some point you need to let it go and, you know, you don't have the right to be an asshole anymore. I think it's clear that whatever the Dominion believes, whatever the changelings believe, they don't have the right to do what they're doing.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think that the interesting thing about the episode is it really does set them up as, you know, I think that they want to do to the Alpha Quadrant, you know, what they did to the Gamma Quadrant. And you know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to talk about because I do know what comes later, but you know, the second part of this two-parter is what it's a profound misdirection, but I also think that, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's indicative of how deeply the Dominion is invested in poking at and testing the defenses and the reactions of the Federation. I think that they recognize that the Federation to a large degree is their main problem to some degree. I don't think that they really get a sense that, you know, the Federation is a group of 150 planets or whatever it is that are all joining together. And I think that there's a certain sense that the Dominion recognizes that the Federation is like them to some degree.
Yeah.
There's also, I think, a sense that they don't really fear you know, the Cardassians or the Klingons or the Romulans.
I think the Cardassians could be, you know, there are the Jem'Hadar and whoever Eris's people are and others are very willing to work with the Dominion. I think that.
Well, I think that I definitely try and steer you away from looking stupid, and I just want to steer you away from that because you were about to go down a road that is not true.
Okay.
So it's not that the Jem'Hadar and Eris's people are working with the Dominion, and we'll just leave it at that for now.
I guess not. But, you know, they certainly the Dominion is at the top, but I get the sense that, you know, the Jem'Hadar, like, all right, we've contracted you to be security.
It's a lot darker than that.
And I'll
just leave it at that.
Okay, I'm ready. Well then, you know, shut up, Richard. where the hell was I?
Well,
let's
talk about the. I think let's go back to part one because
yeah.
I want to talk about part two. I think there's a lot of questions about part two, and I think I want to get your reactions to it, obviously, but. I think part one is interesting because in a certain sense, it starts out as sort of upending the very structure of the show.
Yeah, it's a regular Star Trek show.
Well,
it's what we get to see if Sisko were captain.
Yeah,
and
I think so.
That's, I think, I thought was very interesting. We finally see him taking a ship and going out, you know, and again, we get a glimpse of if this had been a traditional Star Trek show where, you know, it's someone on a ship going to new galaxies. That's what this would look like. I mean, he gets the band together at the beginning. You know, there's this sense of, you know, this is our, you know, we've certainly known that, you know, who our main cast is, but this is the show affirming who it would be. You know, this is who Sisko's Enterprise's bridge crew would be.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, I don't know. I mean, what do you make of the Defiant? I mean, you know, it does change the... I think it does change the show. You know, I think that they have a ship now. So yeah. What does that mean? I mean...
Well, do they have a... What is the stat? I actually, this will be a couple questions I have about, you know, when exactly stuff happened in the second episode. They still have the Defiant. I mean, it wasn't destroyed.
Yeah. Okay, they still have the Defiant. It's still there. I mean, at the end of the second episode, they beam up to the Defiant. So
okay.
they do still have the Defiant. And, you know, I'm not really spoiling anything by saying that they keep it. I mean,
I got the sense. I mean, I wasn't sure how destroyed it was because it implies that
they didn't build all those new sets just to destroy.
No, that I kind of figured, but
so it does. I mean, you know, I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, it does change the show.
It changes the, you know, this is at the beginning, you know, they said the Federation doesn't make battleships, you know, and they're saying, you know, this here we do, you know.
Not only that but I also think that it's interesting that it's that put in the context of the Borg, because, you know, talked about the Borg and the Dominion, which I think is a good analogy and an interesting one. And I think at the same time, the Federation realizes that, you know, and Starfleet perhaps realizes, I should say, more than the Federation realizes, that there are threats out there that they do need ships that are just designed for combat. But at the same time, they're not good at it, right? Like,
no,
the Defiant is not a great ship.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they find all of these problems with it. Yeah, it's...
And also, frankly, that it has a cloaking device.
Yeah, and that there were now the Federation and Romulans have banded together to a limited degree like that. There is a Romulan on a Federation bridge, you know. That's more than anything makes it clear how big the threat is, you know.
I think so. Yeah. And you know, the whole beginning of you know, the search part one, I mean, you know, maybe Sisko shouldn't have surprised them because it's a little like,
oh yeah,
you know, it's a little bad idea to like sneak up on Kira. I'm just saying. But you know, he comes in the ship and he's got the thing there and blah blah blah, and they meet in this new conference room set. It changes kind of the tenor of the show. I think that the show is becoming something else to a large degree. You know, it's not. You know, the first two seasons were very much about stories coming to them, and now, you know, to some degree, I think the show is still going to be like that. I mean, Deep Space Nine is not going away, but they have this new storytelling thing where they can go out and do things now. And it's going to change the show a little bit. I mean, are you nervous about that?
No, but only because, you know, you've been telling me for the past, you know, couple of months, like, oh, season three is great. You know, once you get to season three, you know, then the show really begins, you know. So I figured they'll figure out how to use it fairly well. And I mean, this...
I never said that.
Okay, well, then I am very nervous. No, I honestly haven't thought about anything along the lines of anything you've said in the past 5 minutes. So this is all very new thoughts to me.
Yeah.
Like I said, you know, I guess what I'm more interested in is, I mean, this episode feels like Sisko really coming into his own in a lot of ways. Like, I think even... It's Kira who Jake who says to him, like, you know, you're acting much more passionate. No, it's Dax.
Yeah.
She says, I haven't seen you act as passionate in a while. Like, this is, frankly, this is, in a way, Sisko getting a do-over. He wasn't in a position where he could, you know, really do much, you know, with the Borg. But now he is on the front lines of the Dominion, and there will be, you know... He will never let the Dominion win because, you know, this is his moment. He has been placed to save the Federation, and he's going to do it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't think it's incidental that the Search Part One starts out with, you know, Jake and Sisko having that conversation in their quarters. You know, they went to Earth, they were debriefed, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and so they come into this and they say, oh, well, this is obviously something that is home now. You know, Jake says that. He's like, I think this is home now. You took that stuff out of storage and all that kind of stuff, right? And so that's very much setting it up as Sisko has invested in this place now, and Sisko wants to protect it to a large degree.
And they all have, really. I mean, you know, again, you know, Odo's arc, especially in the next episode, is him realizing that, no, this is his home too. You know, this is, you know, this is where Kira is. This is where they all are. You know, this is what they want to protect.
Yeah, and also that Bajor. I mean, he talks more passionately about Bajor than I think he ever has before.
Yeah.
I think that in a certain sense, he is put into a position of getting a do-over, as the term you use, in protecting the Federation from the Borg. Because, you know, don't forget the backstory of the entire series, or one of the backstories, at least of Sisko's character, is that, you know, he was at the Battle of Wolf 359 and his wife was killed there. And this is a man who was deeply in pain about that. And I think that it's been a few years now and he's a little better. But
we had a few episodes about, you know, him starting to finally get over, you know, or move on from his wife's death. Yeah, and now he's taking it actively, you know.
And he's using that sort of pain and using that trauma and channeling it into maybe a good, I don't know.
Well, I would say he is using it in a positive direction, you know, rather than, you know, again, he's a man who's very decisive in this episode, and he's, you know, all of that in a way that he is even more so than he normally is. And I would say, you know, he's not, you know, this is cold anger, not hot anger.
Yes. I mean, he's very, very effective at what he's doing. And I think that he realizes that. I mean, we'll talk about the second episode because I think that's kind of a mindfuck episode in a lot of ways. But he very much is making the decision that this is not going to stand, right?
But, you know, what I think is very interesting is that section where, you know, Dax and O'Brien are, you know, captured, and, you know, the Romulan is saying, you know, look, we have the information, you know, we need to get, you know, the mission is this, you know, you need to leave, and, you know, and he thinks for a second and then he leaves, and it's like, that's the least Star Trek decision, you know, anyone's made, but it's the most eminently practical one at that time. It's a decision Kirk or Picard never would have made.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think, yeah, to a certain degree, yes, and to a certain degree, no. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, you know, this is the episode of Deep Space Nine that really does mark this as a very different sort of show in its storytelling aims. And I think that that's to a large degree, that's part of it. I mean, you know, if you contrast this with, say, something like The Best of Both Worlds, right, where it was really about the Federation and the Borg threat, but in a real sense, it was a very personal story about Riker and Picard. And that was what the story was about. In this episode, The Search Part 1, this is not Dax and O'Brien and Sisko's story.
Yeah, this
is a larger story about these sort of more galactic implications. And so it does make sense that he would just leave them, I think, in a way. You know, I think that in a similar sense, I think if Picard had been put in this situation, I think he also would have left them.
Well, maybe. We'll never know.
I'm sorry. Am I boring you?
A little. We'll never know.
We will never know. But I think that's what, you know, is implicit in the promise of this, is that Sisko is perhaps not as different as you think he is.
Okay. Well, I thought Sisko was pretty different. He's not Picard. That's what he told Q.
That is true.
Yeah.
So, Kira and Odo, because I think they're obviously they have a friendship, and they sort of, you know, have intimated, especially in episodes like past prologue. I forget the name of the episode, but the episode with which kind of gives Odo's backstory on Deep Space Nine, and they
Necessary Evil.
They reveal that Kira had been there, and Odo sort of let her off, and she ended up killing this guy, and he never found out before now. They have a backstory, and they have a sort of a friendship that is I think beyond, you know, what they can really put into it. And so in this episode, what you get is I think it's really nice for them. I think that, you know, Kira does a good job of grounding Odo in a way.
Yeah. Like there's, you know, I mean, he realizes immediately that it's, you know, complete bullshit, you know, when she's saying, oh, the Bajoran government needs you, you know, she's trying to get her friend into, you know, having a project, you know, and doing something. But, you know, and he starts to call her on that. But, you know, she's just like, look, I'm coming here as your friend. Like, you know, this is at this point, he feels that his, you know, dismissal from security position is a snub. It's an insult. And she's, and he sees it as a dismissal of his worth. And, you know, this is her making it very clear that, no, he has worth to her beyond that, you know. And she, out of everybody, has the most right to say that, because she is the outsider too, you know. She is allowed to say, you know, the Federation is dumb. What are they thinking? You know, that was the dumbest decision they could have made, in a way that Sisko, who feels this way, cannot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's really true. I mean, I think that it's very important to the characters that they're not part of the Federation.
Yeah.
You know, they have very different aims and goals and sort of thoughts about how things are going. And I think that, you know, one of the interesting things, I mean, we started off the episode talking about Odo and, you know, his sort of like history here and finding his people and all this stuff. But, you know, in a sense, I think Kira is doing a really good job of just sort of backing off and you know, realizing that Odo is, you know, going through a lot of stuff right now. And she's just going to sit back and, you know, hang out.
Yeah.
And be there when he finally realizes that he needs her. And I think, you know, it's also an interesting contrast, because it is, I think Odo is not, you know, it's funny because Odo is kind of two minds in this episode. I think that Odo is confused. I think Odo is sort of not disappointed, but he's a little reticent about finding his people. I don't know that he feels entirely comfortable there, which I don't know is something that he would have necessarily expected.
Yeah.
And I also think that he's willing to immediately trust Kira and kind of go on his word. And the nice thing is, the episode, you know, this whole two-parter is resolved because of Odo's investigative skills and sort of instincts, and you
Kira's
know,
as well,
and Kira's as well. Sure, I mean, Kira is not a sideline here.
I would say if Kira weren't in the second episode, Odo would probably not have had the impetus to, you know, discover the portal, and, you know,
right,
you know, he would have eventually found everything out, but much later, you know, and probably after spending more time with these people and getting more. But, you know, yeah, because of her, you know, reaffirmation of her friendship to him, you know, she's the one who gets the ability to go home with him. You know, it's not incidental that, you know, he returns the favor by saving her life and, you know, taking him to meet his parents, essentially. And I mean, I really love her reactions to him when, you know, she realizes he's home. You know, she is legitimately thrilled for him. You
oh,
know,
sure.
She's realized, you know, this is her best friend getting his, you know, lifelong dream. And I mean, I love, you know, when, you know, she scolds him for interrogating them, you know, and all like that, you know, that's very, You know, and she also realizes the depth of how bad it is that, you know, it's turned out that these are the Dominion and they're not who he wants them to be.
Yeah, yeah, because I think that that profoundly shifts his allegiances, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the episode, you know, both episodes do a really good job of, you know, setting Odo up as going through something. I mean, don't forget, in The Search Part One, he's acting out of, you know, character. He's
yeah.
combative. He's sort of, you know, grumpy. I mean, well, Odo's always grumpy, but grumpier than normal. And really, it's all in service of finding his people. They kind of, you know, I like
it. He gets
it because,
this weird, like, homing thing, like an obsession. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I like about it is, you know, I've touched on this a couple times, you know, as we've talked about Deep Space Nine, but I like the fact that the show is willing to go against our expectations about what Star Trek is, because, and not in a bad way, I think the show in a lot of ways is about examining Star Trek and sort of commenting on it. You know, this is very much, you know, I don't know that you would enjoy Deep Space Nine as much if you hadn't put the groundwork in and watching, you know, the original series and the animated series and the movies and Next Generation, right?
Yeah.
And I think you'll find that as it goes on.
Yeah, this is very kind of a Trekkies Trek show in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And I think that one of the ways that you can see that is in the beginning of The Search Part Two, where we get the reveal of Odo's people and Kira's very happy. And in the, you know, at first glance, everything is played as you would expect it, you know? Odo and Kira both sort of are playing the Starfleet role in this episode, in this scene, and are sort of taking them at face value, and they're very excited, and we think, oh, this is great. Odo found his people. Aren't they great? You know,
literally, I wrote a note that said, oh, wow, a collective society that isn't evil for once. And then I ended up writing dot, 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 or is it?
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. And that's what I like about it. You know, I don't know.
It's too good to be true, it felt.
Yeah, well, that's true, because I think that's what the entire second part is really about.
Well, I mean, the entire second episode was very interesting. I didn't get a chance to watch it again, but I wanted to, because, like, through the entire episode, like, everything felt a little off, you know, in the, you know, the non-planet sequences, you know, in the Starfleet sequences, but, like, not in a way I could 100% articulate. And
yeah, I think, like, the, you know, there's certain things that don't really make much sense, but I think that the most telling thing is basically where Sisko flat out says, "Oh, Garak, I never realized we thought as much alike as we do." And it's like, well, yeah, because Garak's not really there.
But I liked that. I did like that scene between, and that's going to be interesting, you know, is when Sisko gets back to Deep Space Nine, you know, is he going to seek out Garak and see if he genuinely does feel that way?
I doubt it.
But, you know, everything is a little off, but it's also stuff that could, you know, characters aren't 100% acting like themselves, but in ways that could be explained by, well, this is season three and they retooled a little bit, you know, and the characters are going to be slightly different because, you know, that sometimes happens. I mean, there were differences in characters in TNG, but that was just evolution. This is because they are acting subtly out of character. Like, that, it was very, like, that was actually a clue that I thought was, but again, you know, the episode is never implausible. It's, we don't think that it's going to happen that the Federation would make this decision, but the Federation has made stupid treaties before, and it's going to make stupid treaties again, and it, you know, there is almost the implication that they're making this decision because the Dominion offered to destroy the Federation if they didn't, you know, and could back it up.
Well, that's what I like about it. There's this very subtle, like, sort of invasion of the body snatcher sense to it. And, you know, I think it kind of actually harkens back to, you know, Whispers, the O'Brien episode from season two, where everything is sort of subtly off and we realize at the end of episode exactly why. But I think you're right. I think it's all sort of plausible enough to work. Did you really question that this was actually happening while you were watching the episode?
No, I fell for it. Again, there were times where I'm like, oh my god, you know, Nechaev's more of an asshole, like, and we've, like, learned who she is, and, you know, we understand that she's, I can't figure out an actual motivation that would, you know what I mean, like,
and interestingly enough, I think the other kind of, you know, thing about The Search Part Two is that, you know, the only characters that are actually in it are Sisko, Dax, and O'Brien.
Yeah.
And so, was there anybody else that was captured? I think maybe Bashir was captured as well.
So and those, the Romulan.
and the Romulan. So those five characters are the only actual real ones we see, right? So the real Quark we don't see in that episode.
Although he has that great speech, you know, his version of the I Have a Dream speech.
Which one is that?
Oh, where he's like, and everybody's going to get, you know, everybody's going to get along together at my Dabo table.
Well, that I think is what my point is all of the characters, I think, are acting in ways that inform what Sisko is really thinking about them, or what anybody is really thinking about them. You know, that's what people think about Quark, right? He just wants people to gamble and he wants to make money. So that's what he's going to do. He's going to be the Ur-Quark in this fantasy. I think that's kind of what Garak is like in this episode.
He's
going to be like this in this episode. And then I think that again, Nechayev, you know, that kind of, I think, really implies that Sisko maybe thinks that she's a little bit of a snake or doesn't trust her.
Well, we did. I mean, the only reason we trust her is because at this point we've seen TNG. I mean, you know, and that was her original characterization with Picard, was that she was, you know, not someone who was very flexible or easy to work with or anything, and Picard didn't quite like her.
Yeah.
But only over the course of meeting with her during these crises and finally, you know, realizing that they were on the same side, you know, the Canapé incident, you know, they came to an understanding, and if they're not friends, they at least, you know, she at least let her guard down a little bit. He let her guard his guard down a little bit, and they, you know, come to an understanding. Sisko and she have not had that moment yet.
Yeah, I think so. And maybe they never will. Who knows? I mean, you know, I think that's kind of the open question at this point is, you know, obviously I think that this sort of fantasy sequence really, I think, to a large degree, feeds into Sisko not trusting Starfleet enough, right? I think that he questions a lot of what they're doing. And, you know, maybe not in a bad way.
Well, yeah, at this point, you know, some of the major, he doesn't think it was right that Odo gets, you know, off of the station. He definitely doesn't think the treaty with Cardassians at this point was a good idea with the Mon-E and all of that. You know, the Federation has made questionable decisions.
And I think that's really what, you know, we talked about a little bit, you know, last season as well. But I think that's kind of one of the questions at the heart of Deep Space Nine is, you know, Sisko is seeing the reactions to the policies that are being made, you know, hundreds of thousands of light years away. And the Federation Council and Starfleet Command and everyone like that is much more insulated in their decisions. And so Sisko is the one who's out there and he's actually having to deal with all the shit that's happening, and he doesn't really appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, too, I mean, the episode is really just it's really well done. I mean, I think that, you know, it's entertaining. There's a lot of really interesting character stuff in there. Of course, most of it isn't true.
Yeah.
But I think we really do get a sense in a lot of cases that this is a group of people that are banding together and they will be there for each other when times get tough.
What I found interesting about this is the Dominion running a simulation. And we're told a lot that the Federation runs all these simulations about before anything happens. So, you know, the Dominion is doing a bit more fucked up version of it. But, you know, I think the series is going to I think it will make sense for the direction to be saying that the Dominion and the Federation in some ways are not so different.
Well, in some ways, yeah, but I think in fundamental ways they are, right? I mean, I think that they...
Well, yeah, of course. I mean,
they both want to sort of tie the galaxy together, but they're doing it in very different ways.
Yeah, I mean, we ultimately want the Federation to win, frankly, if we have, you know, to put money on.
Yeah. Do you... I don't know. Do we want that?
To bet?
No. We want the Federation to win, of course. Why?
Well, spoilers. I mean, the next... You know, series is not called, you know, Dominion Voyager, so I get a
which interestingly enough, no, it's not. I think that you know, the other interesting question at the heart of the Search Part Two is, you know, why the Dominion care that much? Like, that's kind of the question. Like, why, you know, do they really feel threatened by the Federation? Are they really just testing them? Like,
well, I mean, I almost get the sense that for them to do this is not so big of a deal. Like,
they have a lot of these rooms and they do it all the time.
You know, I don't get, you know, it's not given the sense that this is exotic technology for them. And so, you know, they have these people that they happen to have, they might as well, you know, if it turns out that the simulation says that the Federation will be easily conquered this way, you know, why the hell not? You know,
right.
you know, at this point, the Federation has not prepared for battle, and the Dominion doesn't want losses, certainly, you know, even though it can afford some losses.
Yeah.
You know, why take the hard road then when, you know, we can just simulate and see if we got an easy road? That was the sense I kind of got from it. And, you know, the simulation shows that, no, it's not an easy road.
Right. I think that's kind of the question at the heart of the episode is answered very easily, which is that the Dominion is not going to get control as easily as they were hoping. And
but
so,
they also aren't going to give up so easily either.
No, I don't think that they will. I mean, this is obviously not we're not going to, you know, the Dominion is not going to disappear. You know, we are going to see the Dominion again. We are going to see the Jem'Hadar again. Interestingly enough, I think it's funny that you didn't pick up on the Vorta, which is what Eris's people are called.
Okay, I didn't catch the name.
You know, in Borath, whoever the hell that is. But, you know, and that's kind of interesting as well that we have these players now and, you know, where it's going to go, we don't know. Or I know, but you don't know.
I know.
You don't know.
I read the Wikipedia page.
You did not. Are you excited? Are you feeling good?
I'm ready. I want to watch the next episode.
Okay. Well, the next episode is not about the Dominion. Oh. So there you go. Yeah, and the other thing is, I mean, we didn't talk a lot about kind of the production stuff in this episode, but it is interesting. I mean, you know, Ira Stephen Bear is firmly in control of the show at this point. You know, Ronald D. Moore wrote the first part of this, and he came over from the TNG writing staff. You know, a couple writers came over from the TNG writing staff.
Johnny Frakes directed it.
Yeah, Frakes directed it. So there's kind of a nice continuity here that I really appreciate, yeah. And I think that. It's going to be a little bit of a different show at this point, but I think it's also going to be a better show at this point.
Yeah,
not to say that the first two seasons of Deep Space Nine were not good in their own ways, and
no.
I think that they definitely are. I just think that the show, you know, took a little while to find its voice.
There is a subtle difference from the first two seasons, but it's more short now. It knows what it's doing. It's juggling some pretty shocking twists very deftly.
Yeah, because I think at this point, I think that if Deep Space Nine had been TNG only, people were coming to the station all the time, that would have gotten old very quickly. And I think that we were already kind of getting a little sick of that in the second season. So
yeah, I mean, looking at the changing planet is gorgeous. I mean, it's really distinctive looking, you know, as it needs to be. It doesn't look like anywhere else we've seen.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it'll be interesting to see where this goes, you know, and at the end of the day, I think that the third season of Deep Space Nine is a pretty good one. So,
ready.
Look forward to that. Well, if you would like to share your thoughts on this episode of the podcast, please do so by going to trekaboutshow.com, where you can also find a link to our Patreon, which we mentioned at the beginning of the episode. Don't forget about that. And as always, our social media username is Trek About Show, where you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And also, please leave us a positive iTunes review. And check out our other podcast, Trek About Presents, where we're talking about the Star Wars trilogies. That's a lot of stuff going on now.
We're very busy people.
We are very busy people. Next week, we're going to be talking about
the nap we're going to take.
The House of Quark, which I love.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And particularly for one scene. And Equilibrium, which is also a pretty good episode.
All right.
So, Richard, feel good about it.
I feel great.
Good. I'm glad you do. We'll talk to you then.